Hello and a very warm welcome to our podcast of Bruegel. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm extremely pleased to be joined today by Minju. Minju is the chair of the National Institute of Finance of Tsinghua University. And of course, he was a former very, very senior official at the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., and he's an expert on international finance, the monetary system, also currently looking into many different issues, including how to prepare for the next pandemic, which is not what we will discuss today. Today, we will discuss renminbi, the internationalization of the Chinese currency, and what concrete steps are happening at the moment. Minju has written recently an influential article on that, which we want to discuss and bring to you, our listeners, today. Also in our conversation today will be my colleague Alicia Garcia Herrero, who is an economist and a senior fellow at Bruegel and an expert and specialist on monetary policy, the international financial system, and on China. So I'm looking very much forward to a conversation on these very, very important issues. As many of our listeners probably know, the discussion on the role of an international currency has been gathering a lot of steam, a lot of impetus in the last years. We've had not only a discussion about the role of the US dollar, but also a discussion about the international role of the euro. And increasingly, we are also discussing renminbi, which is a major currency by now. And with China's growing economic weight and also growing political weight, its role is set to increase. So let me start by asking you, Professor Minju, about what is your current take? Where does China stand? Where do you see it going? And what is your main message on the international role of the renminbi?
I think there's still a long way to go as a first issue. Renminbi is still a very small portion of international usage. I mean, if you're looking for the today, roughly renminbi only accounted 2% on global reserves, and also a little bit of than 2%, sometimes over on, you know, payments, a little bit more on trade finance. So overall, renminbi usage in the international financial system is very small. Because you think about Chinese GDP account roughly 15% of global GDP. And you think about China has the biggest banking system in the world, right? So the Chinese currency position is still relatively small. I still recall when IMF take RMB into the basket of SDR, grant 10% weight to RMB, you know, which is at that time the estimation RMB probably will go. But in the past 5 years, the RMB more or less remain. I think that's the kind of way. The reason also very straightforward, because RMB is not convertible and China's capital account is not completely open yet. Right. But meanwhile, the other side is we observe more and more countries in the market use RMB as an international exchange vehicle now. For example, RMB become almost the largest swap line of the whole world, right? There are roughly 30 some central banks that have a swap line with China's central bank. Also, RMB also is quite popular in like One Belt, One Road areas. And also in many local markets, you can see RMB like a legal tender or equivalent to dollar. So you will see in the real world, there are a lot of usage in RMB. So that's the whole thing. I think that RMB will move forward because China determined to move into the more market-oriented system. That means we'll gradually open the capital account and also make RMB convertible in some way. Although convertibility is not necessarily a condition for the RMB international usage, it's really the capital account openness. And currently, on the IMF defined 43 items for capital account openness measures. China opened roughly 34 already. So there's still a few key steps to move forward. And I think China is moving into that way. I think meanwhile, when China opened the capital account, so the RMB international usage will increase dramatically because it will become more a vehicle in financial transactions and rather than simple sort of payments and trade finance. It will take some time, but it's moving into that direction.
Well, thank you. I mean, so I think a very clear picture, is still relatively small share, but growing. And of course, much bigger share in trade finance and smaller share still in more sort of classical capital and finance intensive activities. Also because the Chinese currency is not yet convertible and there's also capital account restrictions, capital flow restrictions in place. So can you give us a bit of a sense of, you know, where do you see and how quickly do you see some of those restrictions being lifted? Because at the end of the day, investment into a currency means at some stage full capital account liberalization. So how do you see this phasing in happening?
This is a very good question because the capital account opening is not like you go out, open your door, right? Get the fresh air. No, it's not simple. Historically, we see quite a lot of these cases in various countries, particularly in emerging market and with financial crisis. Key issue is when you open the capital account, you need to build a few key domestic pillars. One is to build a domestic financial market big and deep enough to absorb the foreign capital and let the foreign capital can move in and out. I think that this is the most important thing. And the second issue is you need to have market system. It's not only one market. For example, you need the derivative market, right? If you want to maintain the stability, you need that things. You need a forward market, future market, all those things. So you need a whole financial market system. And the basis on that, the third important issue is you basically need a market-based interest rates. You really need a free all type of interest rates and also bonds market, yield curve. You need all those basic infrastructure for the market. Then you need a good regulatory framework and a central bank monetary policy as well. So you have to build, I call the institutional infrastructures. So that will take time. Can you think about China, in my memory, 40 years ago, when we started economic reform, there's only one bank, it's a central bank. The central bank both is a central bank was also a commercial bank. It took 8 years with separate central bank and a commercial bank, a graduate commercial bank, grow, blah, 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 whatever. And it takes another, 10 years, we get the equity market, get the bonds market. So financial sector is really in an infancy stages in China. So it takes time to build those things. And when we build those things, you also have to build a legal system, which also take a lot of time. So China take a very careful step, reviewed all those international cases, right? We understand that China is a big, but we still have to be particularly on capital movements issues and got to be very careful. So the one issue is really when we sort of two things have to go parallel. When we build infrastructure, I just mentioned step by step, accordingly, we can open. So I think those the things we are doing. For example, we more liberalize interest rates and market-based. We set up the yield curve. So then gradually we open the future market and let capital move into these different things, right? But it will take time. It will take time, yeah.
Well, let me bring here Alicia into the conversation. Alicia, you've been also looking a lot at the Chinese banking system. Yes, Minzhu just emphasized the importance of deep and liquid capital markets, as well as the reform process and the quality of institutions are all crucial factors for an international currency and, you know, factors where China is making progress. But, you know, it takes time. It's a long process. So where do you see China's role in the international currency markets?
First, thank you so much, Professor Zhumin, for the wonderful intro to the renminbi internationalization. And to Guntram to really bring to the forefront the importance, and this is since McKinnon that we know this, and I still remember Chile's financial crisis in the 70s that, you know, yes, basically showed us all how hard it can be if you do not follow the right sequencing, yeah, and you open your capital account before you free interest rates and make sure that your financial sector is strong enough. So I think China is really following this McKinnon sequencing of reform, and it's very welcome. But I want to bring something that I think is essential for this podcast, which McKinnon didn't think about because it was impossible, which is a digital currency. How does this sequencing change in the event of a digital currency? Can you meaning China or anybody else, but we're talking about China here, manage to square the circle? And what I mean to say is to be able to push the internationalization of the renminbi without necessarily opening up fully the capital account, meaning push that thin, which is so important for China, in the event also of a potential demise of the dollar, what's the world going to look like, etc., if the dollar gets in trouble and we have, you know, the 1.9 trillion fiscal stimulus, which surely won't help in that regard. So, you know, in such a difficult world, can the e-renminbi, let's call it e-renminbi, I'm sure you have a better name, but whatever, help China in kind of pushing that internationalization while at the same time taking its time to build what you just said, yeah, the yield curve, the financial sector. So how would you square that circle? That's my question.
Thank you. This is also another good question. I think central bank digital currency is coming. It's inevitable because people use less cash anyway, right? I mean, particularly in China, third-party payments, e-payments is so easy. You know, everything I'm using my mobile phone. I don't need a cash at all. So the central bank have to adapt the change. We see that in the circulations, M0 is really dropping. So what the response from central bank, which is the digital currency? The central bank digital currency, I think, is just to meet the reality. So it's a must. I think it's coming, and it's not only from China, but from all around the world. China started quite early in digital currency issues. We started studying in 2014. In 2017, so we set up the research institutes, basically study on the technology, framework, token, on the technologies, blockchain, all those things. So we more or less get system ready. So last year, we did a few tests. We did tests in Shenzhen, in Shanghai, in Hangzhou, in Beijing. Basically, it's a very low level. It's just replace M0. It's M0 concept. We give people free money because in the pandemic, you want to stimulate consumption, right? So it's a good excuse to give people money. So we give people roughly 150 million RMB in the various locations. The scale beginning in Shenzhen, you can use this money only roughly 386 shops. But now in Hangzhou, they're involving 10,000 shops scenarios, and you can use payments in the e-commerce. So that's much broader usage now. So it's sort of scaling up in some way, gradually try to test. So we also added some smart contract in the system. For example, it's very interesting. A month ago was China's Spring Festival, but because there are some COVID things pump up somewhere, so the authority policies encourage people stay in the city for their spring hospital, don't go back to hometown. You know, hometown is a very, very important for Chinese in spring festival. So why doing that? So they try to give people some incentive. So give you some cash. If you agree to stay, we give you 1,000 RMB or 2,000 RMB. So sort of a little bit of incentive. The most interesting thing is, in that sense, you have to target people who plan to go back, but now decide not to go back. You have to know. So you have to have a smart contract, right, in the system. So you can target people and send people to, it's the same thing like in the crisis, so you can send people directly to SME, for example. So those are very interesting features, I would say. But fundamentally, I think a few basic concepts is important. Number one, it's just M0. You know, it's just a replace physical cash. It's a very low level, number one. Number two, it's a two-level architecture. So that means central bank will not do the retail, will do wholesale. Because if a central bank do retail, central bank open all its book to the public, right? So then the commercial bank will be very difficult, right? Where's their business? So it's a two levels. So central bank give the digital currency to commercial and the commercial to the people, or consumers, but without account. That's the key issue. You don't have to have account. So it's a directly, it's also anonymous in that you don't have their name or whatever, you go through the whole thing. But given it's a small amount, so know your customer, anti-money laundering is not a big issue in those experience. So I think the basic concept is M0, and we'll go that way. So still in the experimental stage. Now, then you ask a big question, how it will help and support China's RMB internationalization. I think this is a huge gap between these two things. So the first issue is China needs to officially launch the central bank digital currency, right? I think the authority haven't decided yet. They don't have a clear schedule yet. It also depends on how the other central banks are doing now. We understand in Canada, in Norway, in Singapore, in Switzerland, UK, US is lag behind. There are a lot of studies on those digital currency issues and also on the blockchain technologies. So I think the whole is moving into that direction. You know, in due course, more or less, I think China will announce, but still a long way to go because there are still quite a lot of technical issues and market issues. On the technical issues, for example, when you do the digital currency, right, you want to make sure put a certain regulatory instruments into the system. Anti-money laundering, obviously, is one customer, whatever. I mean, if you use this digital currency as a formal legal tender, right, not a sort of a small-scale experiment. So that means you will have a decentralized system bottom up from customer, but centralized system from the central bank because to manage the stability issue and the regulatory issues. How do you bring these two things together? This is a very important issue. And who will do the custodian? And who will store the data?
That's right.
Who is the final responsible for customer privacy protection? In what level? Central bank digital currency is also, it's not a cryptocurrency, right? You need to encryption the digital currency in the various stage. For example, in the personal stage, so the person is anonymous, right? Or in the payments transaction stage, or in the storage stage. So in what stage you will encryption the information? This is also a technical issue. And there are a few other technical issues, let me say. China currently is to use what we call the DCEP, which is Digital Currency Electronic Payments. Because if you move to digital currency, digital payments, that means blockchain, you need to try to solve consortium chain and the public chain. So how those chain can work together, make sure the efficiency, because the energy consumption efficiency still the key challenge for blockchain technology at this stage, right? More than that, for example, if a private tech company building a good blockchain system becomes infrastructure, should central bank issue the digital currency on the private-owned blockchain system as a distribution network? How would that impact on the market competition and the financial stability? So there are a lot of technical issues we are carefully assessed to study. So the first issue is you have to pick a proper technical path. But the real challenge is you don't know what is the right technical path because the technology changes every day, right?
Yeah.
So you have to let the market to decide you have to have the competition on all those institutions to work together. The second issue, the most important thing, is really how we bring in the regulatory instruments into the system, building in the system, not from outside, imposed to the system. It's too late, right? And the third issue is obviously is the privacy issues. So they are still really go back to the bottom line. It's the technology issues. And we're very careful assess those things, try to figure it out, to make sure if we run, it's a safe, fair, and secure system.
Wonderful. I mean, this discussion about a digital central bank currency is, of course, a discussion that is extremely important and is extremely actively held, not just in China, but also, of course, in the European Union. I had the pleasure of recently hosting Fabio Panetta, who is the executive board member of the European Central Bank, working and overseeing the file of how Europe will introduce its digital central bank currency. And one important dimension that we discussed, I think we discussed all the dimensions you just mentioned. I mean, the privacy dimension, the regulatory dimensions, the very important technical dimensions, the financial stability dimensions. Because indeed, as you create a digital central bank currency, there is a risk that deposits will move from basically the bank account to a digital currency. And so there are then financial stability concerns, especially in periods of financial distress. And so one of the issues that the ECB is contemplating is really about limits to the amount of digital cash that individuals can hold. And those limits, interestingly, are differentiated also for domestic consumers and foreign consumers. And since we want to sort of discuss the foreign dimension of the renminbi, I want to push you a bit on that. What the ECB was communicating is that while citizens in the EU can hold up to, and I forgot the precise number, several thousand euros, it would limit the amount of digital euros that people outside of the EU could hold. And why was that idea pushed? Well, because I asked, why don't you give higher limits? Because at the end of the day, that's a way of internationalizing the euro. Well, the answer was, well, it could do harm to financial systems outside of the eurozone. And the principle needs to be do no harm to outsiders also. So I'm wondering if you can reflect a bit.
That's a very good question, because the difference between the physical cash transaction and the digital cash is in the physical cash transaction, you basically can see it, right? Unless you do smuggling, but still very limited, because you think of how big is the car, how big is the boat, whatever, you know, smuggling. So its impact on the whole financial system still is very limited, you know, in terms of those type of illegal activities. But in the digital currency world, it can be very different because the money can move over seconds and can move very fast. So in that sense, it may cause also the exchange rates volatility and the capital flow move. But currently, I think it's very difficult to have the system, I mean, the central bank monetary system, to capture that or to take the same quick reaction to stop or to change or to guide that type of things. Because everything happens in seconds. So I think it's nice to start with a precautionary way and gradually, because this is a very new issue, right? It's coming. I think it's inevitable. I think the future, we will see digital currencies coming, combined with a central bank legal tender, digital currency, and the stable currency, stable coin is coming, right? Issued by commercial entities. And cryptocurrency is also part of that by some high-tech company. So all digital. Digital currency is coming, it's absolutely. But that's very new. So particularly for across the board, because it involving capital flow and take a precautionary approach, I think it's a smart. In that sense, the BIS also have directives and emphasize how can we deal with cross-border issues. So go back to Alicia's first question is, I'll give you a long answer, but I haven't touched your last part yet. So I think this is two separate issues. Number one, the Chinese digital RMB will move by its technology path and gradually also along with international and movements. Meanwhile, the RMB, normal RMB internationalization also will move. Whether the digital currency will help or not support RMB internationalization, it's not all clear. It depends on whether people will be happy and to use the digital currency in their transactions, which is we don't know, right? And because for a currency, at the end of the day, it's really, it's the currency's credit, right? Whether people trust it, it's a trust. People want to hold it, to use it. So you have to let the market define. So this is also important. The Chinese authority, particularly central bank, is very careful on technical issues and make sure don't make technical mistake.
Absolutely. Of course, not only by issuing a digital currency, you can ensure its internationalization. But there are instruments that you do not have with a physical currency. So for example, about a third of the dollar banknotes circulate overseas. This used to be a lot of seniorage, not today because rates are much lower. But the point is, this was totally demand driven. Why? Because basically the interest rate on that cash was zero. But of course, with the digital currency, it can be positive. Or it could be negative if, say, you know, Panetta is really worried rather than just creating quantitative controls, Guntram, he could just simply charge a negative rate, meaning...
Well, which is what
and,
he's
and this brings us... Which yes, and this brings us to parallel exchange rates. I mean, we go back to nobody will have a fully open capital account. If you know, like pushing the argument. So, Guntram, it's very interesting that we didn't even start creating a digital currency and we're already thinking controlling the digital currency, whether positively to push it forward or negatively in the ECB's case. I'm letting you talk now, Guntram, by creating some quotas. But I'm saying it is kind of funny. What I'm seeing is that it won't be as free as it used to be somehow, because you can manipulate the rate, the quota, who holds it, because you ultimately you have the centralized ledger. So you don't know who holds, don't you?
That's all sure. There's a few issues in your comments. The first issue is, I think, since it's a central bank digital currency, it's a legal tender, we all agree we should not pay interest rate, right? I mean, for example, in Liberal, they still will pay the interest rates and also has a very complicated mechanism to distribute those interest rates. Obviously, it's not very successful, right? So it's put off later. So you should not pay, but it's moving, and also across the board will have, as you mentioned, a potential parallel exchange rate. That's very impossible because it's a demand and supply, right? And demand and supply in the digital world and the real world can be very different because it's only a special limited group of people will move into the digital world. Right, it's not all. So this group, they behave, their character, and how they run the money and how they impact on the interest rates or exchange rates, still unknown. We're still in a very early stage. So in that sense, a careful study, gradual step by step, in Chinese way, across the river, touch the stone, you know, that the famous Deng Xiaoping says, right? I mean, it's become very, very important. As is also your third point is important for a small, medium, open economy, you particularly got to be careful because, as long as you let digital currency in, people may want to convert their cash into the digital currency because it's much easier for them to manage and to use. And gradually, the central bank will lose the monetary policy transmission mechanism. I think that's also a big concern at this moment.
I'm afraid the time is flying really very quickly. We have already discussed 30 minutes. And, you know, I would love to continue discussing because it is such an important topic. And you've really given us unique insights into the thinking and the activities in China on the renminbi, but more specifically also on the digital currency, which I think I agree with you, is the frontier issue. It's the key issue. It is contemplated around the world and it has major implications, not just for the domestic economy, but also for the currency's international role. So let me really thank you for your time today and for your wise and open words. And let me also thank you, Alicia, for chipping in with great questions and great ideas. Until next time, thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Please tune in again to our podcast on www.bruegel.org. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's really nice to talk to you both.